From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, this hour, we're going to talk about what happened in a Florida school this week, and we're also going to talk about what safety means and how to achieve it. You don't need me to recount the details of what happened in Florida. We are aching for that community that has joined a sickening list of places, a list that is almost uniquely American. We also want to discuss our own expectations of safety and the language we use when talking about our own children. A U.S. senator told NPR yesterday morning that children are valuable assets. Is that an anodyne phrase, or does it point to something more systemic, a way of looking at everything in society as some kind of commodity? Well, later this hour, we're going to welcome your calls and emails, and I know a lot of you have already been expressing some of what you're feeling this week. It has been an emotional week. Let me begin by saying thank you to everyone who listens, who engages, and who interacts with an open mind. Not everyone agrees on this, and that's okay, but let's have a conversation. And my guests this hour include here in studio with us Kimberly Ward, superintendent of Gates Tri-Lie Central School District. Kim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
David Inzana is director of safety and security at the Hilton Central School District. David, welcome.
Thank you.
Joining us from WEOS in Geneva, Trina Newton is with us, superintendent of the Geneva Central School District. Trina, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And on the line with us is Patrick Blanchfield, who is a freelance journalist and academic and associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. He wrote a piece for the New York Times called Guns and the Price We Pay for Freedom. I thought it was remarkable. And Patrick, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start with our guests here in studio, and we'll start with Superintendent Ward. I don't think we need to waste much time on the idea of sadness. Everyone is sad about what we are seeing this week. I want to ask you if it changes anything. I have a son in kindergarten, and there was a really lovely note from the superintendent, someone I respect very much. But I'm also wondering if, beyond just a note home, does this change anything when it comes to safety, what you implement, and what you're planning to do going forward?
Well, it certainly is a heightened sensitivity to the issue, and certainly my heart goes out to our colleagues in education in Florida. I've always been a real stickler about safety and security, so just about 10 days ago, I have been working with a company, Armored One. They were just here and worked with our administrators in our seminar. And that seminar was their level one and level two training. And it's really looking at the concept of run, hide, and fight, and really creating barriers, slowing those intruders down in order to save lives. And so it was very timely. And I think for us in Gates Tri-Lie, our full administrative staff, we were talking about next steps. What should we do next? How soon should we do it? And, you know, I've always said to them, it's not soon enough. But they have a heightened sensitivity. And so we have pulled together with Armored One some additional training, which will happen during our conference day coming up this spring. And so, you know, certainly that has been moved up since this incident. We continue to look at ways in which we can secure our buildings. We have created barriers where we can slow folks down. We are looking at our capital improvement project to continue those improvements, specifically at our elementary schools. And so it's always on in the back of my mind. I consider all of my kids my kids.
Well, and let me ask you and all of you, and I'm going to throw our engineer a curveball here because I've got a couple of sound clips, and John, we're actually going to flip it on its head. Let's go with the comment on school security. So yesterday morning on NPR News and Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep spoke to a Republican Senator Mike Rounds of South Dakota, and Senator Rounds talked about how he thinks schools need to change their very setup, that it has to look much more like a pretty high security office park. Let's listen to some of what he said on NPR.
Nobody wants to see schools turned into armed fortresses, and yet compare that with just walking into this office building right here. Mm-hmm. If you walk into this office building right here, there's locked doors to begin with. You've got to be allowed in one at a time. There's cameras there. Then you go into the front desk where you are then ID'd, mm-hmm. and then you're able to come in with an escort into the rest of the building. Compare that with what happens at a school. So what I think we have to be talking about, if we really want to do this, is to look at whether or not we're prepared to put resources in place that will actually allow for multiple lines of defense on a school-by-school basis.
Kim, you agree or disagree?
agree totally, and we're doing that in Gage Tyli, and I'm awfully proud of that. You know, we just a couple years ago invested in the Raptor system, and everybody that comes has to show their ID, and that's tough for some folks. Well, what do you mean I need an ID? You know me. You see me here every day, and we just have to check and match. I mean, that's important to us. It is a different world, and it's hard to balance being a welcoming community location at, you know, all of our schools and certainly a district as a whole. It's a place where lots of community events happen, but it is a different world, and we need to look at it differently.
David and Hilton, what is changing or what needs to change, or do you view sort of what's already happening as appropriate?
I think that right now we are always looking to improve our safety and security. We've done a lot of the things that Gates has done. We've brought a visitor management system in this year so that people do show ID. They run through a background sex offender registry check. You know, the doors are locked during the school day, so someone has to actually be buzzed in through the main entrance. We have security cameras. We have at the other buildings, the high school and middle school, several security officers that are watching the areas and watching what's going on outside and inside of school. We have a capital improvement project that we're in the process of now, and that part of that is going to go towards improving safety by strengthening our barriers and strengthening our entranceways into the school buildings.
David, do you think there should be more armed officers in schools?
Well, right now in this area, I don't believe there are any armed officers at schools that I'm aware of. I know some of the college campuses. I certainly think it's something that we need to look at. I think it's going to be based on district decision and community decision. I certainly think that it's a conversation that that needs to be had, and truly, that's up to the district and the community whether or not that's something that they want to go forward with.
Okay. Let me ask Trina Newton that same question. Do we need armed officers in schools where you are, Trina?
We actually have a school resource officer who is armed, and we do have a gun safe in the school that's in his office. It's double locked. That has been the practice in Geneva since before I came. We had two school resource officers, and because of budget cuts, we are down to one. And everything that my colleagues have said regarding the capital improvement projects, camera security, the holding, we call it a holding area that you have to buzz people into, and then there's another set of locked doors. We too are taking all of those precautions, and every time we go into a capital project, we look at safety and security.
Do you think we need more firearms in schools as a protective measure?
No.
Okay. Well, I know our listeners will have a lot to say on this. I want to turn to Patrick Blanchfield, whose piece was called Guns and the Price We Pay for Freedom. And Patrick, I want to listen to one other comment made by Senator Rounds to NPR and Steve Inskeep yesterday morning on Morning Edition. He talked about the way we think about our children, and in particular, 17 kids murdered this week in Florida in school. Let's listen to what Senator Rounds said.
I think, number one, you have to recognize that our most valuable assets are our kids. And yet, at the same time, when we start talking about the security activities that we've done so far, we've tried, but in many cases, we probably haven't looked at exactly what it's going to take to provide multiple lines of defense around schools.
Valuable assets is how we describe children, Patrick. What do you make of that?
I mean, it's obscene and ghoulish. And I think it also gets to the heart of the matter, right? Being a human being isn't enough. You have to be human capital, right? Having dignity and not deserving to die is sort of insufficient for grievability. You have to have been capable of adding value. And this gets to the problem, sort of the core problem, and the theme I'm hearing as we discuss all these measures that are essentially triage, insofar as that we have this problem of gun violence, of which mass shootings in our schools are one subset, and because we've decided not to deal with that as a political problem, right, we have, in a move that you could technically call a very neoliberal one, devolved responsibility and paying the burden of that to individuals and the private sector. And it's devolved to individuals in the sense that you know, we of course praise the heroism of people who are killed by mass shooters, slowing them down, but this literally means that their bodies become, you know, obstacles like concrete barriers, and they're supposed to sacrifice themselves, and also our children are supposed to pay an enormous psychic cost of constantly going through lockdown drills. And on the other hand, we've created a $2.7 billion a year school securitization industry, which produces products like the Raptor system, which sounds like a robot that we would be using to drop Hellfire drones on children in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So there's something deeply twisted and deeply wrong here that seems to implicate every single possible dimension of our current social contract, and it's just obscene.
I want to follow up, before I let our guests respond to that, I want to follow up on one point there. You know, when you key in on Senator Rounds referring to children as valuable assets, as being part of the language of neoliberalism, of commoditizing everything, there are plenty of people, and I've been engaging with them on social media in the last couple of days, who agree that there is something obscene about that. Others think it's harmless. It's a way of praising kids. It's a way of saying that kids, when we say kids have value, what we mean is, you know, kids are wonderful and pure and should be protected. Here's something else you write in your piece in the New York Times. Because, Patrick, as you note, we often do talk about what we sacrifice for our freedoms. You write, quote, "Sacrifice is, strictly speaking, a transactional concept. Something is given up in exchange for something else. The implicit paradigm here is of a loss that leads to redemption, a forfeiture that purifies. But there is nothing redeeming or that could ever redeem a dozen dead children. Instead of using the lens of sacrifice, we should think of the toll of American gun violence as waste. Pure and simple. Waste in many ways, as lives cut short, as potential squandered, as futures foreclosed, but also waste beyond any sense that restricts the lives of the murdered to mere human capital. Waste as absolute, irredeemable carnage that generates only more destruction in its wake." End quote. Now, the critics are going to say that this is just semantics, that just about everyone agrees with you there. And Senator Rounds, I bet you if he were on this program, he'd say, all right, I agree with Pat Blanchfield on this. What are we really differing on other than semantics?
Well, I mean, bless Senator Rounds' heart, but like, structurally speaking, right, I think the way we talk about these things and the way we think about these things is very implicates the things we do about these things. And when we talk about people like senators or people who make decisions about budgeting or policy or policing or private sector players, that these sort of constructions of value have real cash value, so to speak, in terms of actions that are taken. And note how, like, the language itself is saturated with capitalism here, right? But, like, more granularly speaking, you can track which schools get more security funding than others. And that very much squares with broader social designations of which children's lives, in terms of race and class, are more valuable overall. So, like, I want us to really push back against the sacrifice logic, both because of how it implicates this language of capital, but also because it sets us up looking for some sort of emotional release, right? The idea of sacrifice is that we could do something that would make it all worthwhile. And the truth is, we have to do a whole lot of things, but we have to recognize, too, that no single thing we're going to do is going to make us feel better in a way that's cathartic or purging in any way correlative to the just sheer grief that we feel and the horror that we feel. So when I talk about waste, I'm trying to talk about, like, slag, right? Like a toxic, corrosive thing that we keep generating, basically because we're much more interested in generating profit.
But Patrick, in this case, I've got leaders of schools, and I think it's they're in a sort of a hard spot because the system is the system right now. And even if there is an agreement with your position on this, school leaders have to decide on safety measures every single day. I mean, they're not always the policy setters at the top, whether it comes to gun laws or economic systems. I mean, what do you want to see from school leadership on this?
Yeah, just to stipulate, I have nothing but love for people that show up in these schools and do this work and that are administrators and that care day to day about the safety of their students. Like, I just want to, like, just stress that. I teach myself. I have people I love and dear friends who are teachers, right? But I just want to, like, just stress here there's a way in which what's happening, as so with so many other things, we ask teachers in our education system to square all these incompatible things and carry all this impossible burden that we won't deal with elsewhere in the society, right? So on some level, if you want to know like specifically what I think school administrators or people in the private sector who work with schools can do, I think actually politicize this. Like, I would love to see teachers strike. I would love to, demanding gun safety measures. I would love to see professors, academics, school administrators, and others speak out publicly and, you know, risking the political fallout of doing that to talk about how this is an unacceptable burden for them, how they're being put in these positions of double binds. And until we actually have, I mean, but again, this is one of these neoliberal things, a political problem is not perceived as a political problem. Is perceived as a technical one. The horizon of imaginability is foreclosed from the get-go, and we have to reject that. So I would like to see, you know, beyond just talking about the specific triage techniques, what we're going to buy, how we need more money, what we're going to do, just simply explicit statements, repeated statements, followed by political action, that this is unacceptable in the first place. And I think there's a vacuum as far as that's concerned. And I'm not specifically criticizing the other guests. I'm talking about our system.
No, I don't take it as criticism of the guests. I mean, I think this is complicated, and everyone wants the same things, and it's a question of understanding maybe how we get there. Kimberly Ward, the superintendent of Gates Chihalai Central School District, what do you make of that?
I think, you know, listening certainly brings attention to the many challenges we face in education, one of which is certainly looking at mental health issues and trying to bring awareness to our kids. You hear something. We're monitoring what kids are looking at.
They did in Florida, though, didn't they?
They did. They did.
I don't know what else needed to be sort of flashed to the a quote-unquote proper authority in this particular case.
It's true. You know, there were some findings that, you know, the kids weren't surprised that this young man showed up. But those are the types of things where we just need to be very diligent in addressing those issues. In terms of the political piece of it, you know, we're always looking for state aid. We have tons of unfunded mandates that we continue to face in terms of balancing a budget. And, you know, we're always getting in front of our local legislators specifically and talking about the many challenges we are facing in our schools, one of which is mental health, one of which is certainly safety and security, you know, being sure that our facilities can be equipped for such incidents. So, you know, we're doing the best that we can. I work very closely with our local partners, specifically our police and sheriff's departments. We're always partnering together, getting out there in front of it to get the message out there. I think some folks tend to say, you know, we're not going to be public or out in the open with these issues. I'm a strong believer in getting out there and being transparent and having the conversations with due diligence to continue to improve the way we do things, certainly in terms of being proactive as well as reactive, because that's the reality of the world we live in, and certainly the profession that we've engaged in. So, you know, this is definitely a deep-rooted issue that certainly warrants additional conversation.
If your teachers had even a day of strike as a way of sort of symbolically protesting their perception of gun laws in this country, would you understand it and would you support it?
I would. You know, supporting it, our kids, many of them come to school because it is a safe place. And we take that pretty seriously. So, you know, it's a fine balance of where do we find opportunities to advocate. But I'd have to, you know, sit back and stand back and say, but, you know, let's keep our kids safe. This is a caring environment. And perhaps maybe there's other ways to advocate for those issues.
David Inzana is Director of Safety and Security at the Hilton Central School District. Is there money in the security apparatus? I mean, there's a lot of talk about this, you know, in sort of criticism of capitalism, that we reduce a lot of this to dollars and cents, and that there's money in the security apparatus. Do you agree with that?
I think that, you know, the security that we try to put into schools is a cost that I think is worth spending money on. Again, it's like everything else. You know, we're all trying to balance budgets and keep them flat. And so we, I think, do things that we can afford to do and hope that those work out. And, you know, always looking for new opportunities, ways to get more funding.
Now, can I also ask you going forward, if you had an infusion of cash for your own budget that you could spend on security, what would you spend it on?
I think that, again, hardening our entrances, improving ways of keeping the element that we want out of our building, in this case, you know, an intruder, I think that that's very important.
Okay. Let me, before I get to Trina Newton, I know one of our callers only has just a brief amount of time, and I see the phone ringing. So, listeners, if you want to join the program, we're going to go without a break this hour, and you can call 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Tina in Rochester first. Go ahead, Tina.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you again for such an enlightening program and for the panelists who are there. While I was holding, I did hear someone start to talk about mental health issues, and that's really the basis of my question. I know that there's a lot of discussion about how do we shore up security and those types of things, but I have a two-part question. The first part is, specifically, what initiatives are the districts doing so that we can catch students so they do not fall through the cracks in terms of profiling students, even if we have to, for those who may be having issues? Sometimes they may be mental health issues. Sometimes it may be just something in the moment that's going on. I'm not a clinician, so that's not my area of expertise, but I am an educator. So I would really like to know what these districts are doing in order to provide more services for students' needs, especially when it comes to counseling. And then the second part is really part of that. I am appalled at the profiling that gets done, especially to young African-American youth, and how sometimes there's justification and there's not justification. But I'm also wondering, and this is controversial, I know, should we be considering profiling of students that we think are at risk based on these propensities that are occurring in our schools? So I'm just offering those as discussions, you know, for the panel.
Tina, thank you. I appreciate the phone call. We're going to start with counseling. Trina Newton, the superintendent in Geneva. Let's start with counseling services. And what would you say to Tina?
This is an area where our board has allocated funds since I've been superintendent of Geneva in 2012. We've added new social workers. We don't have enough. It takes resources. We've added an additional school psychologist, an additional school counselor. We have partnered with many of our community agencies to offer family counseling, individual counseling, either during the school day, after the school day, at the schools. It's multi-layered. We also work closely with our police department. If something is brought to our attention, we work in collaboration with the city police department in Geneva. And they, because of the relationships that have been built in our community, especially around Geneva 2020, there's a lot of cooperation with the parents, mental health agencies in the community, and the school district. So there's a lot of conversations that take place, and we try to get individual students the support they need if that we've identified them as being in crisis.
Kimberly Ward on mental health.
I would have to agree with everything that Trina said. We're doing exactly the same. We have our Board of Education has invested in additional folks, social workers, school psychologists. We contract with Delphi Counseling. We're tapping into many different resources to meet the needs of our kids that are oftentimes at risk. We've invested in our principals, certainly, and our administrators. We have APs in all of our buildings now for just that reason, really keeping track of kids that are really struggling, having conversations, reaching out to families, partnering with families. We do a lot of work with Gates Police and being advocates for the work within the community. We have open communication. We're oftentimes, again, trying to be proactive rather than reactive, knowing that many of our students and families are struggling with these kinds of issues. So I would just have to say we're doing very much the same as what Trina's doing in Geneva.
All right, David and Zana, she also asked about profiling, when it's appropriate, when it's not, and I want to know your thoughts on that.
Sure. So, you know, I wouldn't call what we do profiling. What we do is we have a threat assessment, and that is where we gather a group of people from the school, the principal or an assistant principal, guidance counselor, social worker, security, We'll ask a representative from the police department to come in. And basically, if we feel that that there's some type of threat that was made, we'll look into that and investigate that. And we'll do an investigation. An administrator or counselor will speak with the student, speak with other students that may have witnessed something on social media or heard the student say something, and really then take a look at it and look at the threat itself and decide, how to go from there.
Okay. Superintendent Ward, how about profiling in your district?
I wouldn't call it profiling by any means. It's really identifying kids in need, at-risk kids that just need some love. And I think listening, it really is about relationships. And, similar to what they're doing in Hilton, it's about making sure there's at least one adult in each of our buildings that kids feel they can reach out to, they can talk to. And I believe that's happening in our district. We have a staff from security to even our folks that work in our lunch, in our kitchens, in our cafeterias, even our bus drivers, our bus attendants, they're all on. And they're establishing relationships with kids. Ears are open, eyes are open. They're reporting things, and it really does take a village to raise a child, and it's about working as a team. And so we've really established a culture in the district, and it really is around relationships with our kids, but also with their families.
All right, and Trina, how about profiling in Geneva?
I wouldn't call it profiling either. I mean, just like Kim engaged highlight, it's identifying children that are in need and making sure all the supports are in place to support those children.
Hmm. Evan, could I say something about mental health?
Go ahead, Patrick.
Sure. I really appreciated how the caller brought up the question of race. And I think that that's I want to just stipulate here, I've done a lot, I do a lot of work reading forensic psychiatry, pathology reports of these things after they happen. And I don't think that a lack of profiling in many cases is the problem. If you look at something like Adam Lanza, right, in Sandy Hook, there were abundant red flags. There are always red flags. And in that case, the fact that Adam Lanza was white and Nancy Lanza had a lot of money meant that he could skirt that apparatus of intervention. So I think we need to talk about who we decide to interact with those apparatuses. But by the same token, vis-a-vis just how we're conceptualizing mental health in the first place, I want to call attention to the fact that the mental health that we're talking about here is simply the mental health of the people who are going to be shooters. Right, we're creating a specific category and worrying about them. What's falling out of that discussion is the mental health of all the other students in the school community who are regularly being traumatized by things like lockdown drills or having to imagine being murdered by their own classmates. And I think that we have to have a holistic vision of that that isn't just a reactive triage problem-solving mode. And that means asking hard questions, like, for example, the fact that, if you consider this most recent shooting in Florida, the weapon that this kid used is called the Smith & Wesson M&P. M&P stands for military and police. It's based on a military weapon. There are military recruiters in these schools. And this young man, deluded for whatever reason he was, essentially walks around carrying the same weapon that those people would be encouraging him to carry in another country, killing his classmates. So the extent to which, we're not talking about what's the broader mental health picture in terms of the ethos and the culture and the traumas that we're cultivating in all our students, we're going to be playing. We're playing catch up and flat-footed all the time.
Trina, is there a military recruiting that happens at Geneva?
We do allow the military to come in and set up tables during lunch. Yes.
Do you think it's a mistake?
That's a question that I have pondered for a long time, and I come from a family where. A long military background and a brother that retired from the Air Force. So I think there's two sides of that coin. There are students that truly want to go into the military for whatever reason, and I think it's a choice that should be available to them.
Okay. Kimberly, what about you?
Same. It's about choice. They don't sit in our lunchrooms, but we put out a schedule of, college recruiters as well as those from the military, and students can drop in if that's something that they're interested in pursuing, if that's, certainly something that they want to do post-graduation. So we do much of the same.
Okay. David?
Yeah, I believe that recruiting in schools is important to just give students another opportunity to do something once they move, you know, from high school on to something else. You know, the military is much more than just about going into other countries, invading other countries, or protecting our country. It's about raising people and giving them leadership skills and giving them skills that they can use for the rest of their life. So I think that obviously the firearms part of it is a small portion of the military.
Yeah, Patrick, before I move on to other subjects, I think to be fair, some of our listeners who are veterans themselves would say that you're taking a very narrow view, and they would probably describe as a cartoonish view of the American military.
Well, again, I want to just push back and stipulate. I have family who serve in the military, too. I have dear friends and people I love who serve in the military, too, and I respect and honor their own trajectories and choices. But what I'm trying to get us to do is think about how these are spaces. The schools are increasingly becoming spaces that are militarized, right? Whether it be the presence of guns in them, or the presence of recruiters, or the presence of blast barriers like the kind you might see at a checkpoint in Iraq. We're creating these spaces that are saturated with implicit violence. And it should not be surprising to us in a culture and country that is itself been at war for so long that individual students, individual young people at highly vulnerable times pick up on that violence and act, and some of them act it out. I'm not trying to draw a direct line between the existence of a military recruiter and the reality of school shootings, but I am trying to say that we need to think about violence in our schools as a broader problem and not just as something that we should be doing and thinking about as we pick up bodies and decide where we're going to buy, what we're going to buy next.
I want to get back to our listeners. Don writes to the program and says, if we frame this as freedom to own guns versus safety, then how does this compare to driving? We value our car freedom enough to tolerate 30,000 dead on the roads per year. Aren't we paying a much lower price for the freedom to own guns than the freedom to drive cars? Patrick, that's right up in your alley based on what you wrote about for the New York Times. What would you say to Don?
Well, I would say ironically that we're paying about exactly the same price in terms of body count, about 21,000, 22,000 suicides and 11,000, 12,000 gun murders. So in terms of decisions that we're all copacetic with, those body counts are pretty darn similar. But again, like, we regulate cars pretty darn heavily, right? We don't say that the existence of stoplights, you know, people may drive through them, so why have them at all? Like, we do, there's a kind of a series of essentially learned responses vis-a-vis the problem of this type of violence, which are unthinkable for any other problem, and that I think, you know, the teachers here, I think, would agree, like, these are failures of critical thinking that we probably wouldn't accept from our students otherwise, which seems to get, again, at the broader question of, like, what's going on with our collective social mental health that we somehow think that this type of evil is just the way it is, just the way things are, and what we need to do is we need to fund this, and we need to buy that, and we need to keep an eye out for this particular student. It's, again, it's an accepting a frame, and it's also accepting a frame that we teach our kids to accept. I don't think it's a coincidence, for example, that our culture has gone from, you know, duck and cover nuclear drills to duck and cover mass shooting drills. And I think we should really ask, if we really, you know, as people who care about our kids and our future, what are we teaching our kids to accept as the norm? What are we teaching them to accept as the limits of what's politically imaginable? And if that, and I think, you know, the generation that grew up with duck and cover drills hasn't taken care of the nuclear problem. I fear that the generation of kids that are taught to accept the inevitability of the eruption of random massacres in public spaces is going to be ill-equipped to deal with that, too.
All right, so Steven on Twitter says, this kind of security for 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds? What are we teaching children when security in schools mirrors that of a prison? What happened to centers of learning being safe places? When will an amendment be passed? No armed officers in schools. So Steven is saying, if we're teaching 5-year-olds lockdown drills or mass shooter drills, we are teaching them, we are sort of encoding them with the language of violence in the same way Patrick is saying. But Kimberly, look, my child is in kindergarten in a local school. Most kindergartens that I'm hearing about are doing that, even at, for 5- and 6-year-olds, right? There's active shooter drills for 5- and 6-year-olds now. Is that right?
That is true. They're evacuation drills, so we do practice lockdowns, lockouts, just like we do fire drills. Oftentimes, you know, we're having very different conversations with our elementary level students as we do, you know, that are different than what we have with our secondary students. I think in thinking about this in a more global issue, you know, we're really bringing attention to gaming and what our kids are exposed to in games, and that are very, very violent. And it really is something that parents need to be aware of. So we've done a lot around informing parents, educating parents. You know, you got to look over your child's shoulder and see what they're looking at, whether it's on their phone or it's on their computer. That's of concern to us, too. So it is a very big issue, and there are so many things that play into it. And so we've started to say, this is about play and learn. It's about getting outside, doing things differently, and educating our parents to say, you know, we can't just plop them in front of a computer and think that that's okay. And so as educators, we're trying to expose them to different things so that they see that there are other opportunities and other resources that certainly bring that sense of community, that sense of kindness and acceptance of others. And so when you start to think about being proactive rather than reactive to these issues, they're all interconnected. And in listening to today's program, that those were some of the thoughts that I had and certainly wanted to share.
All right, so listeners on the line, Patricia, Mary, please hang there. We're coming to you. Just let me ask David and Zana, Director of Safety and Security at the Hilton Central School District, are kindergartners in Hilton doing active shooter drills?
All our schools, buildings, we practice lockdown drills.
Should I assume that for a kindergartner, the language is different than the language you use with a high school student?
Yeah, I think the way you discuss it with students, certainly we're going to, try to limit, what is said in order, you know, we're not going to upset the kids or make them feel unsafe. I think as the children get older, you can have more of a mature conversation. And I think just to piggyback off of what Kim said, I mean, it really comes down to awareness. I think, people need to be aware of what's going on around them, what's going on with other people. And then when, you do feel something that's unsafe or unsettling, they need to report it and communicate that. And then, we need to work together to try to resolve the situation.
Trina, active shooter drills in Geneva?
We do not call it active shooter drills. We call them evacuation drills, lockdown drills, shelter in place, but we don't use the language active shooter drills.
Okay. Let me get Patricia in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Patricia.
Hi, Evan. I'm a school nurse in the city school district. And I practice at a number of the schools, both grammar and high school. And I cannot express to you how much anxiety I'm seeing in my students when they come into the nurse's office, especially the young ones. They want to know what I would do if someone came in with a gun while they were in the nurse's office. The anxiety is palpable. And as I listen to the people on the phone talk about all the different options we have in terms of screening and security, the root of the problem is we have people who can buy assault rifles. And so we can continue to dance around the issue and throw money and time and resources, but we are raising a generation of children who are so frightened. Think of the quality of their lives as adults. Fear of the unknown, fear of travel, fear of the other. This is so sad, and as a school nurse, I can't express to you how disturbing it is for me to see how my students are frightened about being at school. So that I will listen to your comments offline. Thank you.
Patricia, thank you. I'll start with you, Trina. What do you make of that?
We've been experiencing the same thing in Geneva for the past few days. As I walked down our intermediate school this morning, you can see a lot of angst, not only in the students, but also in the staff. And I make regular walkthroughs the building, and children run up to me and hug me. Last night, I sent a message out to all the parents, and a message to the children that we are doing everything we can possibly do to keep them safe in school. So we have to keep telling the children that the adults are there to keep them safe, but she's correct. And I left out school nurses when I talk about mental health in the school district. They're probably one of the key personnel. But we are seeing a lot of angst, a lot of kids that are going to our counselors, our social workers, the nurses' office right now. And it usually happens after a school shooting, but this one in particular, because of what is on, what they're seeing in the media, is worse than I've seen it in a while.
Okay. Kimberly?
You know, we continue to send the message that school is a safe place, and we need to continue to send that message. You know, it depends on what kids are being exposed to in terms of social media, or certainly the media as a whole. I know that for us, you know, and I think one of the things that I do want to say is, you know, there's new legislation around safe schools, and some of the mandates that we have is we have to practice lockdowns and lockouts. And so, you know, we're mandated by certain things, but at the same time, want to make sure that students and families know that school is a safe place. And our staff do an outstanding job to really stay ahead of that, to keep them engaged in the learning process, and to continue to assure them that it is a safe place. And I'm very proud of that. So we need to continue to, you know, find ways to protect. Some of the training that we're looking at is really empowering staff. We shouldn't be asking our kids to do anything other than what our staff have been trained to do in terms of protect. And so we continue to look at ways in which we can provide skills to our staff to feel comfortable in that. Just today, you know, I had a staff member approach me and you know, she shared with me, I feel safe here. That has never been in question. And I try to reassure it through messages like Trina. I sent out a Connect Ed message to our families yesterday. Immediately, there were emails and messages out to our staff just to continue to hear from me as the leader of the district that it is a safe place, and we're taking, you know, every step that we can to continue to make sure that our school environment and our culture is a place of learning and is a safe environment for all.
I'm going to get Mary and Spencer Port, who's been waiting. Go ahead, Mary.
I heard your quoting of the person who called our children an assets. And every time I've heard that, I've heard negative things about that. But I've had a poster in my house for almost 40 years that says, children are the world's most valuable resource and its best hope for the future. It's a quote from John F. Kennedy. And I, when I've heard this about our kids being assets, I didn't think of a material thing. I thought of, we have to value our kids more than guns. So I don't see a negative in.
Well, hey Mary, before I let you go, and I know Patrick's going to want to respond to this, there certainly was, if you listen to the rest of the interview with Senator Rounds from South Dakota, with Steve Inskeep yesterday, which is where the quote comes from. He referred to kids as our most valuable assets. He went on to say that he thinks that banning the AR-15 is a red herring, that the Second Amendment should be untouchable, and that we have to do other things. So I don't know that he would disagree with you when he says kids have to be more valuable than guns as assets, but he also is not at all interested in any change to the status quo with gun law, I will say.
I disagree with him on that.
Okay, but. Yeah. So, Mary, thank you for the phone call. So, Patrick, she's referring to JFK. Kids are America's best natural resource. And she's saying, so what that somebody called kids a natural resource, an asset? That this is, again, semantics. Go ahead.
Well, again, you know, I think we could historicize that and say that the specific neoliberal turn in terms of our governance models and our education models and how we fund things happens after Johnson and the failure of the Great Society, right? And I think that the particular rhetorical force of JFK's argument, both then and now, is that you call kids natural resources as a way of highlighting how they're not actually natural resources, right? They're not like oil, they're not like diamonds or timber, right? It's a rhetorical statement. But now, in the present moment, when you have a congressman who, as you said, or senator, has very clear political agendas, I think that asset phrase sounds a little differently in his mouth, particularly when you look at the balance sheet. When you look at the continued existence of this problem. So the idea, I mean, like, I would even contest the senator's own claim that they're the most valuable assets. And in this way, I'm agreeing with the caller, right? Like, stock prices of firearms manufacturers appear to be, if you were an alien landing on this planet and looking at our news and, you know, our market reports, appear to be a much more valuable asset than our children are.
Well, and Patrick, this is where our listener Ellen writes to us and says, I haven't heard any discussion about following the money. A recent program spoke of U.S. senators, congressmen and women, and the president receiving millions of dollars from the NRA. And if we could ever get money out of politics, we might be able to pass gun control legislation. This is a consistent refrain we are starting to hear a lot more of. But I'm not sure even what Ellen, the emailer, is talking about is... I'm not sure if she wants gun control legislation or if we have to use a word, if we're going to be intellectually honest about changing the equation. For those who want to put the United States in league with other countries, developed countries that have far less guns total, far fewer, you would need confiscation. And that's not a word I hear often. Patrick, what about you?
I mean, no, I don't hear it all. I mean, again, this gets to the question of what's the horizon of what's politically imaginable.
And that's right? Not right now. That's just not.
No, yeah, it's not. The NRA's victory and the victory of the gun lobby and the right wing on that front has been absolutely total. And that has caused the entire conversation to drip steadily more and more right. The default position at this point, even from nominal progressive Democrats, is, you know, we won't accept this one particular law. Maybe we could think about a ban of this particular novelty accessory, the bump stock, right? But do they talk about defunding our massive industry of arms manufacturers? Never. Is the idea of banning handguns, which are responsible for untold numbers more homicides than mass shootings carried out by assault rifles? It's not even thinkable. And now, I don't agree with the position that we should ban all guns. Maybe make that clear, but I think that there should be room for that position to exist in our political debates, right? We allow people to, you know, I don't agree with vicious anti-abortion foes, but we allow that to exist, and, you know, we have certain outputs in our political conversation as a result of there simply being that voice. The fact that that voice doesn't exist, that that's outside the threshold of imaginability, speaks again to this acceptance of what we can change or what we can't, that we enter into even before we have a conversation about what to do. It's a preemptive surrender, and it's tragic, and it bespeaks such incredible moral and intellectual impoverishment on our society, it will damn us.
Well, and you heard Kimberly Ward from Gates Child I say earlier, she does not support more firearms in schools as a means of safety. The NRA has said, that, why not arm teachers? Why not guns in every classroom to let people know these are not safe spaces? Well, here is an email from a listener along those lines saying that what we need for safety is more firearms. He says, as long as schools are gun-free, they'll be targets for crazy people. As far as I know, the most recent guy purchased his gun legally. Schools may not be such targets if we still had gun clubs in them, like in the old days before people started targeting schools. David and Zanna, what do you make of that?
I think that person's saying, you know, meet fire with fire. So, you know,
does it make sense to you?
I guess that's one side of the, you know, of the coin, you know, to look at it. I'm not going to give an opinion that, you know, says we should or shouldn't. I think it's a discussion that, again, comes down to the community and the district, whether or not they believe that firearms would help make the school safer. I think if you have a majority that agree with that, then that's something you look at. And if it's a majority the other way, then you don't.
Do you think you could train teachers to operate firearms and feel comfortable with them having guns in classes?
I believe that, you know, I was actually a police officer for 27 years, and firearms training was one of the things I did for a number of years there. I believe that you can train someone how to fire a weapon. It's a skill that needs to be practiced regularly. It's not something you can train a person once and then just say, okay, well, when you need this, go ahead and do it. I believe that definitely in the heat of the moment that not everybody's going to be able to, you know, probably rise to the occasion and actually use a firearm. And I don't expect that everybody should or, you know, I don't believe that that's something we should be doing is arming the teachers. I don't necessarily think that's a great idea, my opinion.
Okay. And Kimberly, you said no to that. No to arming teachers.
No, but I want to clarify that we do have a partnership with Gates Police. So we do have SROs in all of our buildings, including our elementary schools that are, again, establishing great relationships with our kids. I think for me, our training that we just engage in with our administrators and certainly preparing for in the spring is guns aren't the only forms of weapons. And that's really part of our training in terms of what else can we do or what else can we use in order to slow an intruder down. And that comes from, you know, all kinds of ideas and thoughts around that. And I think that's why we're especially interested in getting this out to our teachers so that they feel empowered and engaged and certainly competent and in protecting, because there isn't an educator out there. And it goes back to Florida. And we know there's been, you know, a lot of certainly honoring the teacher that lost his life once he, you know, was in the hospital, I believe. And, you know, teachers will do whatever they can to protect their kids. And it's what we signed up for. It's what we are as educators. And I couldn't be more proud to be part of the profession.
In about 20 seconds, Trina, can you envision a future where teachers are armed or at least have firearms available to them in classrooms as a safety measure?
I hope not. I definitely, I mean, as a superintendent, as a former teacher, I don't believe there's a place in schools for teachers to carry firearms.
Trina Newton is the superintendent of the Geneva Central School District, and it's always good to catch up with you. Trina, thanks for taking the time for the program today.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Kimberly Ward, Superintendent Ward from the Gates Chi-Lai Central School District. And again, we all wish the circumstances were different today. Thanks for being here and being part of the conversation, Superintendent Ward.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to David Enzana, Director of Safety and Security at the Hilton Central School District. David, thank you for coming in as well.
Thanks, Evan.
And our thanks to Patrick Blanchfield on the line with us, a freelance journalist and an academic and faculty member of the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, the author of the piece in the New York Times, Guns and the Price We Pay for Freedom. If you want to check that out. Patrick, thanks for the time as well this hour.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, we got a lot of more phone calls and emails, couldn't even get through. Unfortunately, we'll continue the conversation at the next time. Wish there weren't a next time. Short break, and we're going to try to lighten up a little bit as we end the week on Connections Next.